Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another special Friday episode. And I know that normally we try to take Fridays off from putting out a podcast and making you guys listen to my voice. But, you know, when we have opportunities to bring great creators on that I know all of you enjoy hearing about their creative process and the projects they have coming up, we have to take advantage of it. So this special Friday episode is a spotlight on writer Michael Morrisi. So first of all, thanks for joining me, Michael.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
So we have several of your properties that we're going to talk about today. I'm really excited about them. So for those of our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the name or the work, why don't you give us a quick background of how you got into writing, you know, comics and prose both, and where they may have seen some of your work before?
Sure. Like you said, I'm Michael Morrisi. I've been writing comics for quite a long time. I think I started what most people would know me from as Hoax Hunters was my first bigger project. That was with Image a good number of years ago. I've also written Roche Limit for Image. I've written Burning Fields and Curse for Boom. I've written some DC stuff, Flash a little bit of Superman. And some other stuff along the way. A novelist as well. My first book, Black Star Renegade, came out just this year. I have another book called The Throwaway. It's a spy thriller that comes out in June. and the sequel to Black Star Renegade next year. So busy times, which is good.
Yeah, as a freelance creator, it's always good to be busy, especially as opposed to the alternative.
Absolutely. Yeah, the alternative is terrifying.
So just to give a little background, I had never read any of your work when I reached out to you, but you were always a writer that I kind of paid attention to. And a lot of that just being that I've been doing this for so long that I've become friends with a lot of creators. And I always see when you have work coming out that other creators are always talking about it, you know, in addition to the fans. And so it's always been on my list, man, especially Roche Limit. Always been on my list, you know, critically acclaimed. I really need to read that. I love sci-fi. And in fact, I bought the collected editions on Comixology, I think well over a year ago, maybe. And I just, when they were on sale, I just hadn't got around to reading it. And then I think most recently I saw somebody post on Twitter about your new comic you have coming out from a Vault, Wasted Space. And I was like, you know what? It's time for me to sit down and dive deep into Morrisi's work. And so that's when I reached out to you and you sent me the preview copy, read it, loved it. And I kind of, you know, grew from there. Hey, let's talk about Black Star Renegades. Let's talk about Roche Limit as well. So let's start there. Let's start with Wasted Space. Why don't you tell our listeners what that book is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm super excited about it. I haven't been bashful about it online. You know, I think it's the best comic work I've ever done. And I'm going to keep saying that because I believe it. And it's not just because of me. It's because of, you know, the team I'm surrounded by with Hayden on art and Jason on colors and Jim on letters and Adrian doing edits and Tim Daniel on design. So I'm going on. But I do think it's the best thing I've ever done, and I'm not afraid to say it because I'm surrounded by great people, and Marguerite, of course, on covers as well. But the book itself, Wasted Space, is about a guy named Billy Bane, who is this galactic prophet, or at least he was this galactic prophet who got orders from an entity known simply as the Creator. And one day he gives the wrong, the wrong message. That he thought was the right message and totally, you know, screws the galaxy. And we're picking up the story years later when he's in exile and just drugged and out of his mind and drunk and a total shell of what he was. And I like to think of it, what I've been saying is it's like if Phil K. Dick had written Preacher is what I like to think of it as.
Yeah. And that really grabbed me when, you know, I first read that tagline and I wasn't quite even sure how to take that. I'm like, okay, is it just kind of this, you know, mashup between this kind of down on his luck, you know, lovable loser kind of guy and sci-fi? But really, it's more than that. There's a lot of layers to that. So what are some of the themes that you're trying to explore in the book?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, there's like the intimate theme and the broader theme. I think, starting with the broader theme, you know, one of the things we're going to be, you know, exploring right from the top and exploring, all throughout, is about systems of control. And we see it in religion and government. I'm talking about in the book, and family, and it's about all these things that like aim to, you know, manifest your destiny for you. And I think that's an important thing right now. I mean, one of the points I wanted to make with the book, one of the reasons I wanted to make this book, I mean, it was born out of like really a lot of, I don't know, frustrations about the world. You know, I, if you read my work, I think you know where I stand politically, and that's okay. You know, I'm a pretty open dialogue kind of guy. But I have my stance politically, but despite where I fall, I really have frustration across the board of like, you know, we can fight one thing and fight another thing. Like, you know, what I'm alluding to is like fighting Trump. I still think that we're kind of trapped in a really broken system. And I wanted to like explore like all these things that control our lives. You know, it's not just one person, or it's not just this president at this time or this Congress. It's the whole thing. And it's about all these things that are, you know, pulling the strings of our lives. And I think sometimes we get too wrapped up in one thing or two things that we begin to, you know, lose the forest for the trees, so to speak. And a lot of it, you know, Waste of Space was born out of that frustration of like, there's just so much going on. And I just was expressing that and expressing my, you know, anger over, you know, these things that are empowering our lives. And maybe we don't know it, and maybe we just ignore it or whatever. And intimately, you know, a thing that I deal with often, it's in Roche Limit, it's in Black Star Renegade, it's in Waste of Space, is failure. It's about what happens when you fail, or what happens when you're not meant to succeed. And that's what Billy goes through, and that's what Molly Sue, the other character, goes through. We even see it later with, Billy's friend, the fuckbot, F-U-Q, Dust. And it's, you know, we all fail, we all fall down, and I think, we're often defined by how we pick ourselves back up, and, or if we pick ourselves back up. And so a lot of my stuff often finds myself dealing with failure. It's just a giant fear of mine. Something hangs over my own life. It's something that I wrestle with all the time. And so, yeah, I think that's like the more intimate stuff that's going on. So those two things are kind of balancing out, like I said, the broader and the more intimate, and we'll see where that takes us.
Yeah. And in a way they're almost linked. I mean, that's how I saw what I got out of the first issue, because like I said, such a simple presence, or premise rather, this guy, you know, he was, you know, for lack of a better term, he was somebody, right? And then he screwed up, he failed. And, you know, rather than try to like fix his mistake or own up to whatever, he runs away and hides, you know? And I think at probably at different times in our lives when we've failed or we've screwed up, there's always that temptation to just kind of stick your head in the sand and, you know, go hermit crab and try to ignore it. And so, you know, he runs away to the edge of the galaxy, and, you know, you look around at the world we're in today, and you do kind of wish, and some people do, they stick their head in the sand and they don't want to look at what's going on in the world, and they don't want to take any, you know, personal responsibility or try to make a change. And so, you know, can that work, or is it to get?
Yeah, you're right.
Right. And try to find a path of redemption.
So I totally agree.
I'm very curious to see if Billy is, you know, is he going to be redeemed? Is he going to be redeemed in a different way than we expect? Like, you know, what's going to happen there? So, as the story goes on, I'm sure like organically that's going to happen. And how long of a story do you have planned?
It is going to be 10 issues, all told. So we're going to do two sets of five, arcs, and that'll be it. You know, I know where it ends. So there won't be any, stakes of sticking the landing or anything. I like to go into stories. You know, I've never really done it ongoing, and I probably could, I'm assuming, I hope I could, but like everything I've done has been limited and, intentionally limited, you know, like Roche Limit, I knew where I was going, Burning Field, and Waste of Space. I know exactly where it's going, cause I know what the point of the story is. And, I just like to get there.
Yeah, well, that's fair. And I'm sure a lot of your fans probably appreciate that. You know, sometimes some of these books, they, you know, they start doing well, and then you feel like they're padding it a little. And so, I mean, I know as a reader, I like to know, you know, that there's a destination in mind.
I do too. I absolutely do too. Yeah, there are comics is tricky, you know, like, especially if you, you know, getting a, making a successful comic book is so hard. It's so hard. The market is, especially now, things are not good, you know, in comics, you know, in terms of market wise, I mean, content wise, it's never been better, I don't think. But you know, market wise, it's, things are tough. So if you have a successful book, you know, the impulse is to keep it going. And I get that, you know, cause you don't want to let go of that because right. there's nothing that says your next book's going to be successful. So yeah, it's a tough line between, you know, always that struggle between art and commerce, and you try to satisfy both as best you can, but it's not always easy.
Yeah. Cause you want to maintain the integrity of the story, right?
Yeah, as best you can. It's absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the other themes that I kind of sensed in issue one, and that's faith as a motivator. And you kind of already touched on this as, you know, it's one of those controls that's in our life that a lot of people who are you know, born and raised in some kind of belief system or you know, religion, they probably don't even think of it as something that constrains them and restricts them and puts control in their life. So, so faith as a motivator, and whether that be like, is it faith in yourself or is it faith in a higher power? Is that something that just came out organically with the way the story got set up, or did you kind of have that in your mind when you set out to tell the story?
No, I have that in mind because I think faith is a tricky thing. I mean, like you see it with, for example, you see it with Billy. You know, he sees and hears the creator, right? But the thing is, does that mean it's real still? Like, we don't know. I mean, he doesn't even know. And he wrestles with the fact that he's like, I just might be crazy. You know, like, this might all be in my head. I mean, I don't know what reality is. I don't know what is happening. You know, like, I thought I believed something, and this thing known as the creator deceived him so badly that he's like, how could this have all gone so terribly wrong? But I think we all have, you know, It's a weird thing. We all have faith. Like, even if you're an atheist, right? You have faith that you're right. You know, like, maybe you don't have faith in a higher power, and that's okay. But you still have to have some sense of belief that what you're hedging your bets on is right. You know, and that is still a sense of faith. It's self-faith. It's, you know, or a faith, you know, shared with a group because there's a lot of atheists, but you still have some sense of you're believing in something. And we all, even when you go down that path where you say, okay, now I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, but you're still defining yourself in certain ways. You know, if you're saying that, if you're declaring that, you are still ascribing to a certain way of thinking, a certain way of living, a certain way of dealing of your relationship with God. I mean, you can't just deny it's around in other people. So other people have this faith. So it's still, even if you don't believe it, it's still around your life. So it's still informing part of your life, you know, like, and the same thing as somebody who does have faith, you know, it doesn't mean you have faith in a specific God. You could just have faith in the universe or faith in, you know, the force, you know, whatever. But there's still that factor that I think that we all deal with, whether we recognize it or not. And that is a big part of the book. It's like you always are ascribing to something. Even people who say they ascribe to nothing, as Billy eventually does. That's not true. You know, that's not true. Like, Billy does have some sort of center of, like, what his life is, even if his life is, you know, existing through rejection. That's still something.
Right, exactly. I mean, choosing not to believe in something is having faith that it's untrue. And it's something that unifies us as an animal, as a species, right? The ability to choose to believe in something or choose to reject something so that you're, you know, believing the opposite. And I mean, this goes along with exactly what we're saying. I don't think that other animals have the level of intelligence to have faith or lack of faith. I mean, obviously, I don't know that for sure because I, you know, not them, but I believe that. I have faith in that. And so, you know, as humans, it's just something that unifies us. We can all relate to it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we all touch upon it in some way, and good experiences and bad experiences. I want to capture the good experiences too. Like, it's, yes, I'm trying to bake that in as well, because I'm not, by no means trying to, shred faith or shred people who have faith. Like, I don't want to, you know, go down that path as well. I just, you know, it's the same thing with, like, you know, it's so easy in your work. Like, we, you know, we talk about Trump, you know, there's so many things now that, like, are tearing apart Trump, and you know, like mocking him and stuff like that. And I don't have a problem with that, but I think there's a certain degree of like low hanging fruit, where it's like, you know, well, okay, you know, like I get it, you know, and that's okay. But like, I wanted to, with Waste of Space, be like, not necessarily take a side. And I think that what that does is free you from the necessities of like having to say certain things and having to, approach things in a certain way. I just want to look at them. I don't want to comment on them. I want to look at faith. I want to look at the systems of control. I don't necessarily want to comment on them because that's not my job. That's the art's job. That's the reader's job. You know, I don't want it to be like me telling people what to think. I want to just present the questions and not the answers as best as I can.
Yeah. And let the reader, you know, explore. I mean, that's the fun of getting to discover a new world that a creator is creating.
Yeah. And then you get to have that, you know, you get to have that experience. You know, some of my favorite writers, you know, like for example, like Kurt Vonnegut, you know, you always knew where he stood politically and morally and philosophically. You always did. But like, he never really in his work, like, was like, boy, isn't this terrible? You know, like, I mean, you got the sense, but like, he, it's more powerful. There's a TED talk that I listened to once with Andrew Stanton, who was the writer and director of WALL-E, and he does all this Pixar stuff. And he's like, it's never powerful in fiction to give readers or viewers or whatever. Don't ever give them four. You give them two and you give them two and you let them make four. You know, like, and I feel like so much stuff that I read, unfortunately, when you try to get so political, it's just 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, rather than like, okay, here's two and here's two, and you make four on your own. And then it becomes, that's the power of fiction, is giving the ingredients and let the reader, viewer, whoever make those connections on their own. That is powerful. Four is not powerful. Two and two is powerful.
Yeah, because then you're being, you know, you've got to let them form their own opinions, because then it, that belief is a little more ingrained than just, you know, being told something. And then you always, you know, you'll always have doubt. Is that really true? But you discover something on your own, you know, that you have one of those light bulb moments. I think it's going to stick with you a lot longer.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about the world building that you've done with Wasted Space. Did you have all that in your mind already, or did you collaborate with Hayden Sherman, the artist, to kind of build out what the world was going to look like and the character design and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think it's a good mix of both of us. You know, Hayden brings definitely an amazing sense of design, weird designs like that I love. They're so weird, they're so cool, and they're just so perfect. He's so good. I mean, that kid is just going to be a superstar. He should be already. He's getting there. But in addition to that, like, it's like, you know, like for my thing, like, and I do this with, you know, Black Star and Roche Limit as well. I like to, you know, economy is like my main thing. And I think that my method for world building is to tell and show what is essential to the world, like what you need to know for the story. And I feel like so many where other things I see, books or comics, something like that, stumble is when they're giving stuff that you don't need to know, because the more stuff you give, the more questions you get. And it makes the world feel so big. And sometimes that works, but like most times it doesn't. You know, like you have to keep it economical. And I think the more economical and lean it is, the more powerful, the better that world feels. And that's what Wasted Space, like, was that and Black Star is like giving a certain economy of world that feels real, feels lived in, but like it's not too much. You know, it's not like an abundance of details. Because while you think, oh, the more you give, the better, not necessarily, because like you can give too much where it gets confusing, or like I said, it, like, you know, like you start talking too much. It's like incriminating yourself. Like the more you talk, the more likely you are to, like, you know, confess your guilt. You know, like, just Aiden was amazing at executing it and bringing his own quality and characteristic to it, his own flavor and his talent and just raw sheer ability and imagination. And he did a great job. And yeah, his storytelling is great. I mean, there's nothing, I couldn't say more positive things about Caden. He's amazing. And he really made the book just what it is. And I'm super happy with it.
Yeah. I first discovered his work actually just recently on the Cold War series he's doing with Christopher Sabella at Aftershock. And then when you sent me this, I'm like, wait, Hayden's drawn it? Oh, yeah. I can't wait to see how this looks. So, yeah. Awesome, awesome work. Definitely. I couldn't really picture anybody else drawing this world.
No, he's one of those head-turning artists, you know? He just has... He has his own style. I mean, he's, you know, reminiscent of, you know, Miller, Chaykin, stuff like that. But like, you know, everybody has some sort of shade of somebody else. But like, he definitely has his own thing going on, and it's remarkable.
Yeah. So for those of our listeners that want to go and order the book, because you know it's not out yet, so you'll have time to go tell your retailers that you want it. When's the release date? When's it going to be on comic book shelves?
I believe it's April 18th. It might be April 25th. But I think it's April 18th. And to echo what you said, I implore people to tell the retailers. Like I said, things are tight and tough in comics, and retailers are feeling the pinch. They're working hard. They're doing all they can, but it's not easy. It's never easy being a comic retailer, and it's especially hard right now. So they need to know that the things they order are going to get purchased and not just sit on the shelf. So going to the retailer, going to your shop and saying, just simply saying, I want to get this book is so valuable to Vault, the publisher, to me, to the entire creative team, because it gives retailers that confidence to say, oh, okay, four people told me about this book, so there's something going on here. I'm going to order 10 copies or 15 copies or whatever. That retailer confidence is so valuable. So please, please tell your retailers.
Yeah, when the alternative is that they don't order it, and you think you can just walk in there on the, you know, the 25th or 18th, whatever, and I'll let you listeners know when it's getting close, obviously. But yeah, you walk in there and it's not there on the shelf because they're like, "Well, I didn't know anybody wanted that." I mean, that's your alternative. So you're just, for your own sake, please go and let them know that you want it. And I don't know if you've heard about this, Michael, but Diamond is in the process of building an app. It's very close to release, where you'll be able to basically go online and order a book from your local retailer and then go and pick it up when it's there. So that's going to be a godsend for the industry and for some of these smaller books.
Wow. That's a game. I didn't know that. That's a game changer. That's huge. It makes it so much easier. And I feel bad, like, telling, you know, go to your shop, you know, like, get in your car and drive to your store and remember to tell them. Like, that's hard. It's not easy. I know. It's, you forget. You got other stuff going on. So it's tough. It's tough on retailers. It's tough on readers. Everybody. It's nice. It's you're asking a lot. And I wish I didn't have to, but that's the necessity. But that app will be just, whew.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Diamond is supposed to be unveiling it and doing a full demo of all its functionality at C2E2 this year. So I imagine you will probably be there, being that that's where your hometown, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I will be there. So I'm definitely going to write that down so I can go see it for myself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's switch gears here and talk about your prose novel. For you listeners, I was lucky enough to get a copy to review for the podcast, but interest of full disclosure, I only got it a few days ago. That being said, between putting out, you know, seven podcasts a week, birthday weekend, and my full-time job, I'm almost done, and it's so, so good. I was reading it before I had to put it down to come meet up with Michael to do the interview, but wow, it's really, really great. So I'll let Michael go ahead and tell you all what it's about, and then we'll dive deep into a little bit of, sorry, not too deep, because I want you all to go and buy it, read it for yourself. So obviously we're not going to spoil anything, but yeah, it's really, really good. So why don't you tell our listeners what Black Star Renegades is all about, Michael?
Yes, I'd love to. And thanks for checking it out and for the kind words. I really appreciate that. So yeah, Black Star Renegades is a story about a young guy named Cade, who, through circumstances, I don't want to reveal how, but he, through circumstances, gets a powerful mystical weapon thrust into his hands. And unfortunately, he's like the worst person to wield this weapon. But if he doesn't figure it out, the galaxy's totally screwed, because the evil Praxis Kingdom will take total control, and that would be bad. It's kind of, you know, space opera adventure, Star Wars, is the ultimate, you know, pinnacle of what we're going after. But Star Wars, Guardians of the Galaxy, classic pulps, you know, Buck Rogers, stuff like that. It's adventure. It's fun. It's not like hard sci-fi. you know, it's just fun adventure, pulpy, fun, fast. That's the thing. That's what Black Star is all about.
And how did you come about with, I mean, is this just kind of the culmination of a lot of, you know, different ideas and your love of the genre? Is that how you like kind of came up with the idea for the story and built the world and the backdrop and everything?
No. So weirdly enough, it's a very strange origin story, for Black Star Renegade. I actually, in addition to writing comics, you know, I've been writing, you know, prose here and there. I have a background in prose, grad school, all that, you know, kind of blah, blah, blah stuff. But like, so it's not like something totally foreign to me. And while I've been writing comics these years, I've been pitching, novels as well. And I've been pitching one editor in particular, at St. Martin's, where Black Star Renegade is published through. And, one day, after, you know, years of many rejected pitches, my editor, this editor, Mark, called me and he was like, just simple as can be. He's like, you love Star Wars, which is true. I love Star Wars more than anything in comics, movies, anything. Star Wars is my everything. He's like, you love Star Wars, write me something that's like Star Wars. And I had the pitch ready in like a week. got accepted pretty fast. We decided to do two books and we were off to the races from there, which is, it's a very rare story. It's weird because like on one hand, I could see people be like mad because it happened so fast and so easily. But the context is I had been pitching for years and I'd written numerous samples and pitches and everything that went nowhere. Before all that glory, there's a history of misery preceding it. So it was luck, but it was also earned luck. But yeah, that's how the book was born. And, I just turned in the draft for the second book, a couple weeks ago.
And did you find once the initial pitch had been, accepted, that filling out the details and the backdrop and building the world, did that come relatively quickly? Or did you have a bit of a struggle with that? Or is that like the fun part?
It's definitely fun. But yes, it was pretty quick, but like it also took to really, really nail it and get to the feel and character of the book. Like, you know, it took a lot of drafts. It took a lot of like each draft kind of learning a new thing of like, okay, you know, this is something that's not working or this is something I want to be better. And a lot of that stuff was like the world, the texture of the world, the fabric, the tapestry, however you want to call it. That wasn't just, didn't really come together until a few drafts in. Like I always had a sense of the world, like we were talking about earlier. I wanted to be just economical and easy, like Star Wars. You know, Star Wars is like, okay, Endor is the forest moon. It's just a forest, you know? Tatooine is a desert. That's it. You know, like, I mean, I didn't want to be quite that simple because I don't want to rip on it too hard, but like the brevity of that kind of world building, like I want to capture because I like that world building. I like keeping it, key simplicity, for me is key. But that was where the fun too. It's like figure out these worlds, like how to make them unique, how to make them, what's cool about these places, how they could give them their own, look and feel that would be, you know, cool and powerful on the page. But I love doing that stuff. So it was cool going through that experience of like, you know, getting there after revision after revision.
Yeah, and you mentioned Star Wars specifically and a few other classic sci-fi worlds. Clearly, you're drawing inspiration from those. Do you do it almost subconsciously or do you kind of pick and choose? How does that process come about?
A little bit of both. Like I like to put like little Easter eggs in there. Like, you know, in Black Star Renegade, there's stuff from like, you know, a lot of Star Wars, but there's also this Dune, Star Trek, Mass Effect, is in there. There is some books, the Book of Three, like the Black Cauldron, there's some stuff in there. There's Arthurian legend stuff in there. There's a lot of stuff, but there's also stuff that like slipped in. I've had pointed out to me since, that was like, oh, I didn't realize I'd done that, you know? And it's kind of, it's fun. It's cool. But I think it's just like that, you know, nerd overdrive brain that's just always kind of like cycling Star Trek reruns in my head. And all of a sudden like, oh, there's a Star Trek reference. I'm like, I didn't realize I was there, but it's clearly a Star Trek riff that's happening there. So that stuff just, it just happens. That's the fabric of my life and my world. So it's like, it's impossible for it not to happen.
Is that a challenge though? I mean, obviously being a sci-fi guy, you've got all this in your subconscious, if not right there in the forefront of your mind. Is it a challenge to make sure you're keeping the story unique and you're not drawing too much from something that came before?
Yeah, because you want to make it your own thing too. And I think we got there with Black Star Renegades. Like I'm very confident that, like, yeah, like it's a love letter to Star Wars. And I don't mind wearing that on my sleeve. But like I also think in a lot of ways it's an anti-Star Wars book. You know, I mean, one of the big things about it is that, like, it's literally like, I say it's like, what if something happened to Luke and the other guy, you know, Han had and Han has to take over. You know, it's kind of, again, while it's in that tradition, it's also rejecting a certain thread of the tradition of Star Wars and a lot of other sci-fi works where it's like the Messiah threat, you know, where it's like this one lone hero is going to save everything. Harry Potter or Buck Rogers or John Carter, whoever, like this one person is going to do it all. And Black Star Renegades actively, you know, rejects that tradition. And, you know, I don't scorn it, but I also wanted to like say, to look at things from a different angle and do something a little bit different. And I think that was a big help. And I didn't really discover what that was really the beating heart of the book. It's like the third draft or so. And once I, you know, discovered that, it really started to become its own thing in ways that I've never had before.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. That's kind of one of the overriding things. One of the things I find the most fun, you can't help rooting for Cade, you know, because you could tell that he's, well, you know, maybe he's not the best one to do this, but he's who you got. So you're gonna root for him. Right. And I think that kind of leads up to the next point I wanted to make is making the characters relatable, right? I mean, none of us is perfect. So I think in that way, we can all relate to Cade making, you know, bad choices or, you know, not picking the best path and then being like, ah, crap, you know, and it really grounds the book and it definitely makes it relatable in my mind anyway.
Yeah. Well, thank you. No, I mean, that was one of the big purposes of that. It's like to, again, going back to the thing of failure. I think flaws are more interesting than heroics in a sense. That's what makes people really tick. That's what makes people really defines who people are, you know. I think that's the most interesting thing. That's why I think like for example, like The Dark Knight is the most interesting superhero movie because it's centered so much on Batman's flaws, you know, and like he begat Joker in a certain sense, and Joker exposes who he is and what he represents in this like terrible way, and it makes it far more interesting than if Batman were just perfect and there was no conflict like that. If it was just punch, punch, kick, kick, you know? You know, that makes it more relatable. That made Batman more relatable, made Bruce more relatable. And that's how Cade functions too. Like he's flawed, you know, he's deeply flawed, but he wants to do more, you know, but he struggles with achieving more. He struggles with whether he can achieve more, which I think is an important distinction. You know, there's that whole, you know, something called, you know, which you've heard, I'm sure you've heard of, or, you know, listeners have heard of, like the imposter syndrome, where it's like you never feel like you truly should be doing what you're doing. And that's a big thing. And I feel it all the time. And those things, I think, make it realistic. I think like the other characters too share that. Like Kira has her own kind of things that she's hidden, her own you know, secrets and flaws and problems and hangups, and I think that makes her, you know, like, yes, she's like a badass pilot, you know, like it's cool to have that, like that Starbuck, but like she's also has like depths of her own that makes her just, I think for me, I love her character for all those things that she overcomes. And the same goes for so many other characters in the book. I mean, Gahali, the villain, I think is even as evil as she is, you sort of get it because like she is rounded, you know, she's had bad things happen to her. She's done bad things and all that stuff, I think only kind of helps bring everything more and more to life.
Yeah, and I agree with you because it's that word that you use there, overcome. I mean, that's what makes it heroic, right? Like if you're perfect and you're all powerful and you're doing good things, it's like, are you really being that heroic? Because there's no risk, right? I mean,
Yeah, true. Yeah, but totally.
You have risk and you are flawed and you're still choosing to do the right thing. That's courage. You know, that's heroism in my mind anyway. One last thing I want to talk about.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, for sure.
Black Star Renegades before we move on to Roche Limit is the pacing for prose versus comics. It's very different. Do you find that it really takes like a different headspace in order to tell the stories in the different ways?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Two different animals completely. Own set of challenges, own sets of advantages. I kind of, you know, for Black Star, I kind of want to capture almost that, like, you know, comics share a lot of pulp sensibilities. Obviously, comics come out of pulps as well. You know, the pulps and comics and books both share a strong tradition in the pulps. And pulps, you know, the one thing that, you know, one thing that defines pulps is like that breakneck plotting, you know, like that, the pulp adventure, you know, it's like it's just fast and furious and, you know, just keeps going. And that's what I wanted to do with Black Star. So that stuff I've done also in comics, you know, so I was able to kind of like, use that as a crutch, you know, that kind of like that, you know, rapid fire pacing. And I think it worked, you know. I don't know that pacing would work for every book. It worked for Black Star Renegades. I don't know that, you know, it would maybe not work for another thing, but for this, because of what it was, it worked. But the two things otherwise, you know, prose and comics are definitely, very, very different things in how you structure them, how you prose that, or how you put them together. And it's cool because it keeps you fresh, keeps you on your toes a little bit, especially me as I'm like sliding from one to the next, keeps those muscles, you know, keeps those muscles going. But they definitely have their very distinct things going on, and, they're just not the same. That's the thing. Like, I think, is taken for granted, you know, prose and comics are not the same, you know, comics and TV are not the same. They're just not, they're different. They're different to consume, and they're different to make. And they're just not, it's just, they don't cross over as easily as I think a lot of people think.
Yeah. I hear that from a lot of creators, cause I've heard it both ways. I know creators who started out in the, you know, the comics industry, and then tried to transition over to prose. And for some of them, it worked. For some of them, it didn't. It was too different. Didn't work out for them. Scott Snyder's a good example. Somebody who struggled in the prose world and then, you know, moved over to the comic world and it just clicked for him. So yeah, I mean, I think it, you know, clearly it's a different animal. And for some people that, you know, they can work in both and go back and forth. And for some, you know, it doesn't work. I don't know. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, totally. I mean, some people can go back and forth, you know, for comics and TV or whatever, or, you know, some, you know, Rucka can do, you know, he can do seemingly anything, but, you know, like, you know, or video games or whatever. And some people have that fluency, but it's tough, you know, like I definitely struggle with it. I still struggle with it. And, I love both of them, but it's definitely makes it, you know, a lot of challenges to your day. But it's cool. I mean, I love it.
Well, yeah, you mentioned TV, so I guess that's a good time to transition over to Roche Limit now. I've only read, as I mentioned, I have them digitally, but I haven't had a chance. I've read the first issue of the first series. So I think there's three series, right?
Three, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, 14 issues, three volumes. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think the first two volumes are five issues and the last one's four. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, and so the exciting news about this property that you have is it was recently picked up by Sci-Fi to have a pilot done. Is that right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, pretty strange, pretty crazy.
So before we get into that exciting news, let's give our listeners kind of the elevator pitch. What's the premise of Roche Limit?
Sure. So Roche Limit, I haven't done this in a while, so I'm a little rusty, but Roche Limit is a series that's about humanity finds this planet, planetoid that's, you know, edge of our solar system. We've made a lot of advances in space travel, obviously, but it's this planetoid that is habitable. The only catch is that it's like on the cusp of this weird space anomaly. We don't know what it is. We don't know if it's anything, but, you know, it's the only, you know, habitable thing. So we at least got to make a go of it and see. So a colony gets built on Roche Limit, and things go terribly wrong. And that's set up for it. You know, like, it's all three volumes take place at different times in Roche Limit. So one is like our near future. Volume two is like, I think like 80, I forget how many, like 80 years after that. And volume three is question mark. I sort of know, but it's meant to be question mark because you have to read it to know, like, there's very strange things happening in volume three.
All right. And what drove you to choose that title, Roche Limit? Was it just kind of the setting, or was it what the actual meaning of the term?
Was actually, yeah, the actual meaning, like, Roche Limit is about a Roche Limit. The term is a, is the, let's see if I'm getting this right. That's like the distance in which one body's mass and gravity and pull overcomes another body's mass, gravity, or pull. So, like, for instance, in the rings of Saturn, you know, it's like the ice formations and different stuff that's in there. But in the rings of Saturn, one of those is one of Saturn's former moons. And what happened is that the moon got caught in Saturn's Roche Limit and disintegrated, broke apart. Saturn was too powerful, overwhelmed it. And I don't think it's a totally common thing that happens in space, but it does happen. And, you know, it's kind of metaphoric. It's like the distance in which things come apart. And that's kind of what, again, a failure thing is kind of like what the book is drawing about. It's like this colony that's built with the best intentions that, like I said, goes very, very wrong. And it's the conditions in which it all comes apart, comes undone.
Yeah, and I definitely got the sci-fi feel, and the mystery of the first arc is very, you know, it's right there at the beginning of the story. Didn't necessarily see the horror elements that I've seen some people talk about, but really it's the whole overall story is really a mashup of all three, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, like, I think horror in the sense that, like, Alien is horror, or like Event Horizon is horror, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I don't think it's like, you know, slasher horror or something like that, but, like, you know, there's a sense of horror in the book and our elements to it, but it's more like it's sci-fi, heavy as sci-fi, but yes, horror is accurate without question.
And this has been, again, like I mentioned at the top of the podcast, you know, very critically acclaimed, well received. So I imagine it has a pretty solid fan base, because even these years later, I'm still hearing, hey, Roche Limit, gotta read it. So it must have a pretty well-built fan base. So what was their reaction when the sci-fi TV show announcement, did you start hearing from a lot of fans like, oh, I can't believe this is happening?
Yeah, I mean, the reception was crazy. It was amazing. And I know that fan base exists. I'm very grateful for it. Very, very grateful for it. And I get often emails and messages like, oh man, when are you going to do some more Roche Limit? Like, never, you know, it's done. The story's told, you know, like, I don't know what else to say about it. I wish I could, you know, like I said, like at the top of the interview, you know, it's hard to let those successful books go. And Roche Limit was the most successful book comic I've ever done. You know, it was really successful. I mean, not to boast, but like, it was very successful. And I remember when we had the numbers for the first couple issues, I was like, oh man, I wish I had planned this for longer. You know, like, but I'm glad we stuck to our guns. I'm glad, you know, we told the story that we wanted to tell. I mean, who knows? Maybe I do write a prequel in there one day or something. Somehow find a way to tell a story, because I still love that world, and I still think, you know, people still respond well to it. And yeah, I you never know, you never say never, but yeah, the reception was great. People really have hung with that book, and yeah, it's a book that's always going to stick with me, and I'm glad, because I truly think we did some cool things. There's great art, you know, great people involved, and I think it's a cool little weird sci-fi horror existential comic that it's not quite like anything else, and I dig that.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna be. It's close to the top of my stack. I'll put it that way. The only things above it are things I specifically have to read for podcasts coming up. But I'll definitely reach out to you and give you my thoughts after I finish it. I'm looking forward to checking it out. But why don't you tell everybody how?
Please, yeah.
Why don't you tell everybody how you got involved with bringing this story to the Sci-Fi Channel?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's funny. I just wrote about it on my blog, so it's fresh, fresh in my mind. A few years ago, the Roshan was originally optioned almost 3 years ago by Heavy Metal. And Heavy Metal is doing, at the time, they still are doing like their, production. One of the vice president there, I think that's his title, vice president. But anyway, he was a producer on one of my favorite movies of all time that was hugely, influential on Roshan. It was this little sci-fi movie that a lot of people have heard of, not enough, called Dark City. It came out in 1996 or 97. One of my favorite movies of all time. If you watch that and you read Roshan Limit, you're like, you can totally see where those parallels lie. And, so they optioned it. As soon as they made the announcement, they got a call, from Fremantle Media, and Fremantle, best known for, they produce, the American God show on Starz. So they were like, this looks rad. We read it. It's great. Blah, blah, blah. How about we partner up? And Heavy Metal was like, sure. How do you say no to Fremantle? Who they've also done like America's Got Talent and stuff like that. They have a lot of reality shows that are insanely popular and all that. So they have a great track record. So these two guys got together, and then the next step of the process, all the while sci-fi was kind of, they're in the picture, kind of lingering. They're interested. They pulled back and they're interested. They're kind of like, they're in the mix. Because the thing is, like, TV and film are different in this way, because, like, if this is a movie, Fremantle and Heavy Metal can just be like, okay, we're going to put some money up and we're just going to make this movie. And if you make a movie, you can do something with it. You can distribute yourself. You can turn around and sell to Netflix. You can, it's a one and done thing. You have a thing and you can go out and get it seen somehow. Festivals, touring, whatever. TV shows, you can't do that. Like, TV shows, you need a network. And even if the network is still like, now Netflix is a network, or Amazon Prime is a network, but you need someone to air it. So you can't just go and just start making a TV show. So you need a network involved. And part of what sells a network is, giving a sense of what this show is. What is this thing? What is a Roshan Limit TV show? Like, sure, you can read the comic, but that doesn't tell you what a TV show is going to be. That's why generally you have to bring in somebody who defines the gives the vision of what this thing and what this show will be. And for that, Fremantle and Heavy Metal brought in a writer named Will Pascoe, a writer producer who is fantastic. I mean, he's written for Shut Eye on Hulu. One of the Starz shows. I forget which one, but most notably, he was a writer for years on Orphan Black, which is, for the pinnacles of modern television. So he is good. He knows his stuff. Very sharp, very good writer, very good storyteller. And, he loved the comic, and he had this great vision for what it can be and how it can function. And everybody was like, yep, this is the guy. They brought him into sci-fi, and they were able to say, okay, here's Will. Will's going to tell you what the show is. And he did. And sci-fi said, yep, that's awesome. Let's do it. this is kind of, rapidly, recapping things. It took longer than this. But anyway, that's how it all kind of came together. And then sci-fi decided, okay, they went and hired him officially to write the pilot. And that's where we're at right now. Will is currently writing it. I've read his outline. I've read his notes. I was there for his pitch. I absolutely love it. It's amazing. It makes me jealous that he's getting it down so well. But it's really, really cool. It's really smart. It's very mysterious. Spooky, and it's great. It's a great, great thing that he's doing.
Yeah, and I feel like it should, The Expanse, the show on sci-fi that's based on a series of novels, has a really strong fan mm-hmm. base and is very good, and good production values. And so I feel like this kind of has that same sensibility. And if you can tap into that audience, there's no reason why it won't be a huge success.
Oh man. Like I said, wasn't your words to God's ears, something like that is the thing. I don't really know, but point being, I hope you're right. Cause The Expanse is great. I read the books. I love the books. I love the show. And I know it's very popular and successful. So that we had a modicum of the expanse of success, I think we will all be happy.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. What are some of the biggest challenges of adapting this story to the different medium, the small screen?
I think a lot of it, because, the biggest thing, because Roche Limit was a limited series, it's about, expanding that world. I think you have to do that in any adaptation, but like, there's a little bit more like, how do we make this bigger? How do we draw certain things out? What else do we add? And adding the right things and adding the right characters and giving them the right things to do that like retain the core, because you don't want to, and Will was good about this. You don't want to drift too far away from what it is, because then, what are you making? What are you doing then? And it's a balance of like, okay, how do we retain? Like, how do we really, really look at this story and say like, okay, this is what Roche Limit is. Okay, this is the beating heart of this. But how do we now take that and now make it into a new medium? And also while you're doing that, how do we expand and build on that to make it, because you can't just go in there with like, okay, here's what the first 60 minutes are. I mean, like Will had to figure out here's like what the first 60 episodes are. I mean, not that much, but like he had to have a plan, and like a sense of direction. And you have to be able to make good decisions of where you're going to take things and what that's going to look like. And, that was definitely, I think, a challenge for everybody because it's, Roche Limit, again, it's an enigmatic series. It's a different series. So it's not just like you're like Kick-Ass where you're like, well, how do you make a Kick-Ass movie? It's like, it's easy. that's like a slam dunk, like not to say that Roche or Kick-Ass, either one is better or worse, but there is a more, some projects, some books offer a more simplicity in translation where Roche Limit was a little more challenging, a little more tricky. But I think that like we'll solve those problems excellently and made it even better.
Yeah. And are you still involved? Are they looking, does Will call you up and ask for advice, or are you involved at all now that it's been kind of optioned and in production?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, Will and I talk all the time. We just met a few weeks ago. We've met a few times. I was out in LA and we hung out and talked about the book and the show, and actually talk about Star Wars. He's a big Star Wars fan. So we're always talking about that. But yeah, and he doesn't have to do that. But he does. And he asks me stuff and shows me what he's working on. And I'm just, very grateful for that. He keeps me involved. It's very cool. But, at the end of the day, and I'm totally okay with this. At the end of the day, it's now his thing. The TV show, the comics will always be mine. They're not going anywhere. But the TV show, when it happens, will be Will's. He's the showrunner. He's the, leading, vision. I mean, he'll have writers in there with him, working with him, directors, stuff like that. It'll be a collaboration, but ultimately, like, Will is the driving force behind that. And it's his. And that's okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, you're okay with that. Now, I know sometimes fans can be not okay, and then invariably that's what they'll blame on or lay the blame at when something doesn't, isn't successful. Oh, you didn't stay faithful enough to the book, or you stayed too faithful. You know how fans can be. But I'm glad to hear, and I'm sure that the fans of the Roche Limit story are happy to hear that he's at least picking your brain and asking for advice. And as you said, kudos to him for doing so when he certainly doesn't have to.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And, it's funny because I just saw the movie Annihilation, which is, based on a book, one of my favorite books. And I was that fan because I was like, what is this? Like, this is not like the book. And I was so mad. So I definitely know that frustration. And, so hopefully we don't cause that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, okay, well, again, I really want to thank you for your time, Michael. Spend nearly an hour talking to you about all these projects. I did check. So, listeners, Wasted Space currently is set to ship on, or be on sale, I should say, on April 25th, 2018. And again, okay. I'll be mentioning it when it gets closer. Get out there, let your comics retailers know that you're looking for this book, because now's the time they're going to be ordering it. It's one of the things that makes it so difficult to be a comic retailer, as I talk about on the show all the time, is you order your product 2 months ahead of time. It's insanity, really, when you stop to think about it. Ordering it 2 months ahead of time, sometimes sight unseen. It's crazy. But definitely get out there.
It's crazy.
Let them know. Wasted Space April 25th from Vault Comics. Black Star Renegades is in bookstores now, so go and pick yourself up a copy. It's really good. I highly recommend it. Is it available digitally on Amazon as well, Michael? Do you know?
It's you know, Kobo, Nook, Kindle, audio. There's an audiobook, so there's tons of options to get it.
Okay, great. And I'm sure you can find Roche Limit at places like you know, InStock Trades. Probably can track down single issues, you know, if you want. And I know for a fact it's available digitally on Comixology. So I encourage you to go and check that out. Let me know what you think about it, because I'll be reading it very soon myself. Do you have any other upcoming projects that you want to mention, Michael? I know you mentioned you just turned in the kind of the first draft for the second part of Black Star Renegades. Anything else we should be looking forward to?
Nothing I can discuss contractually. Soon that there's other stuff that'll be coming out, but nothing that I can talk about right just yet.
Yeah, I get that a lot. Perfectly fine, totally understand. If any of our listeners want to follow you on social media, or you know, follow along until they'll know when you are allowed to make that next announcement, where's the best place, like social media wise or online, to follow along with what you're up to?
Twitter, you know, at Michael Morisi. My website's michaelpmorisi.com. And I'm on Instagram, I think, just at Michael Morisi again, however that works. So yeah, I'm around and I try to be responsive as best as I can. So yeah, I'm there.
Okay, listeners, and I'll go ahead and put all those links in the show notes. So if you want to follow along, so you can find out when Roche Limit's going to finally hit the airwaves or what Michael has coming up next, just go and check out the links in the show notes. So again, Mike, I really want to thank you for your time. It was great chatting with you, and I hope to run into you at a convention or a show soon, so we meet in person.
Yeah, likewise. It was a great chat. I really appreciate it, and it was a blast. So thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. All right, everybody. Once again, I want to thank you all for listening. Be sure you go to thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. All the content is now migrated over to LRM Online with our partnership that's going on, so you can find all the previous content there. While you're at LRM Online, be sure to check out all their other pop culture coverage on TVs and movies and video games and all that kind of great stuff. Comic Source is also on Twitter at twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow along with us there, so you will know when we drop new episodes. And we also put a lot of convention coverage on there. And speaking of conventions, Manny and I will both be at WonderCon in Anaheim, California, coming up here in a couple weeks. I believe it's the 23rd through the 25th. And I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.